pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a man who flew across the entire United States of America, ocean to ocean, back when almost nobody believed you could fly across a single county without breaking something. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. And today we're going all the way back to the autumn of 1911 to a tall, cigar-chewing, half-deaf giant of a man named Calbraith Perry Rogers, and the flimsiest, most crashed-up, most stubborn airplane that ever earned a place in the history books. Now, before I get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you what, by the time you hear the end of Cal Rogers' story, you're going to understand why we mark the milestones, because getting there is never a straight line. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's get into it. Picture the country in 1911. The Wright brothers had made their first hop at Kitty Hawk only 8 years earlier. 8 years, that's nothing. The men flying in 1911 were the very first generation of pilots this planet ever produced. There was no such thing as a license the way we think of it. There were no airports, there were pastures, there were fairgrounds, there were racetracks with the horses shoot off to one side. And into that world walks Cal Rogers. He was a big man, 6'4", near enough, built like a lineman. He came from serious American stock, the kind of family that had admirals and heroes in it, going back to the War of 1812. He'd had scarlet fever as a boy, and it left him hard of hearing, so hard of hearing that he probably couldn't have passed a medical for much of anything, even if such a thing had existed. He loved fast things, motorcycles, fast boats, automobiles when an automobile was still a rich man's toy. And in the summer of 1911, he went out to the Wright Brothers Flying School in Dayton, Ohio, and he learned to fly. You want to know how much instruction Cal Rogers had before he decided to cross a continent? About 90 minutes. 90 minutes of duel spread over a couple of days. Then he was a pilot. That was the standard of the age. Now here's where it gets interesting. There was a prize on the table. The newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst had put up $50,000, an absolute fortune in 1911, for the first aviator to fly across the United States, coast to coast in 30 days or less. 30 days. And the clock could start any time, but the whole thing had to be finished before the offer expired in October. $50,000. And nobody had claimed it, because it was frankly close to impossible. The airplanes of the day were made of spruce and wire and cotton fabric, doped stiff. They had engines that put out maybe 35 horsepower on a good day, less than a lot of lawn tractors you'll see mowing the grass at your home field. This weekend, they had no brakes, no instruments to speak of, no navigation but a road map and your own two eyes. You flew low, you flew slow, and you followed the railroad tracks. Pilots called it flying the iron compass. You literally followed the rails. Because the railroad went where the towns were, and the towns were where the fuel was. Cal Rogers decided he was going to win that $50,000. Now, he wasn't a wealthy man himself by the standards of his family, and this expedition was going to cost a mountain of money, so he did something that was brand new in 1911, something that feels awfully modern when you look at it. He got a sponsor, a commercial sponsor. The Armour Company, the big meatpacking outfit out of Chicago, had just come out with a new grape-flavored soft drink. They called it Vin Fizz. And they agreed to bankroll Cal Rogers if he'd paint the name of their soda pop all over his airplane and call the whole enterprise the Vin Fizz Flight. $5 for every mile he flew east of the Mississippi, $4 a mile west of it. So the airplane, a Wright Model EX, a little single-engine pusher biplane, a stripped-down racer version of the Wright design, got christened the Vin Fizz Grape Soda. That's the name that ended up in the Smithsonian. Let that sink in for a second. Let me paint you the machine itself, because if you're used to modern airplanes, you need to understand what this man was strapping himself to. The Vin Fizz was mostly open air. You sat out front on a little seat with a wing behind you and the engine and propellers behind that, chewing the air. There was no cockpit, no windscreen worth the name, no cabin. Cal Rogers sat out in the slipstream in a business suit and a cap turned backwards, with his cigar clenched in his teeth, and the wind of 40-some miles an hour beating on him hour after hour after hour. The controls were levers in a cradle you leaned in. The engine sat right behind your back, spitting hot castor oil and unburned fuel, and that stuff would coat you, get in your eyes, soak your clothes. Old-timers who flew rotary and early engines used to say you could always tell an aviator by the smell of him. Castor oil and scorched cotton, and it was loud. Not jet loud, a different loud. A hammering, clattering, chain and sprocket, wooden propeller kind of loud. right at the back of your skull for hours. For a man who was already half-deaf, I've always wondered what that did to him. On the 18th of September 1911, Cal Rogers lifted off from a racetrack at Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn, New York. Thousands of people came out to watch. He climbed up over the rooftops, turned west, and set off to find the Pacific Ocean, using a road map and a string of railroad tracks. And behind him came the part of this story that most folks forget. A train armor paid for a special train to follow him. Three cars. One was fitted out as a rolling workshop, packed with spare parts, and, I mean, packed. Spare wings, spare rudders, spare skids, spare struts, spools of wire, bolts of fabric, cans of dope, a spare engine, rolls of spruce, because the men running this show understood something Cal Rogers was about to prove over and over and over again. He was going to crash a lot. Riding that train was Charlie Taylor. Now, if that name means something to you, you're a real one. Charlie Taylor was the mechanic who had built the engine for the original Wright Flyer at Kitty Hawk. The first aircraft engine, he was the first aircraft mechanic in history, and every A&P who turns a wrench today is walking in Charlie Taylor's footprints. And here he was, riding a train across America, patching up the VinFizz every time Cal Rogers folded it into a fence post, because that's what happened. Rogers hadn't been in the air but a couple of days when he came down at Middletown, New York, clipped a tree, and piled the VinFizz into a chicken yard. Tore it up badly, broke the airplane, cut up his own scalp, and put himself out of action for the better part of a week while Charlie Taylor and the crew rebuilt the machine practically from scratch. And that was the pattern for the whole trip. He'd get up, he'd fly a leg, and then the engine would quit, or the wind would flip him, or he'd misjudge a farmer's field and go over on his nose, and down he'd go in a heap of splinters and wire. Then the train would catch up, the crew would swarm the wreck, Charlie Taylor would work his magic, and a day or two later, Cal Rogers would climb back onto that little seat, light a fresh cigar, and go again. They tallied it up afterward. Depending on who's counting and how you count a hard landing versus a genuine wreck, Cal Rogers crashed or made forced landings somewhere between 15 and 40 times crossing the country. He broke bones. He got burned when a cylinder blew and sprayed him with hot metal and oil. He was at one point or another patched up about as many times as the airplane was. And here's the thing that gets me, the thing I want you to really sit with. The 30-day deadline for the Hearst Prize came and went while Cal Rogers was still somewhere over the middle of the country. He knew it was gone. The $50,000, the whole reason a sane man would attempt this, evaporated. He was never going to make 30 days. Nobody could have, and Cal Rogers kept flying. Think about that. The prize is gone. The money's gone. Every reason a spreadsheet would give you to keep going. Gone. He's bruised. He's burned. He's half deaf. He's soaked in castor oil, and he's flying an airplane that has been rebuilt so many times that it's barely the same airplane. And he points the nose west and keeps going anyway, because he said he was going to fly across America, and by God, he was going to fly across America. Somebody asked him about it, about quitting, and he basically said he'd started this thing to get to the Pacific Ocean, and he intended to get to the Pacific Ocean, prize or no prize. That's the whole man right there. Now let me tell you about that airplane by the end. The VinFizz that lifted off from Brooklyn and the VinFizz that finally reached the West Coast were, for all practical purposes, two different machines wearing the same name. The crew rebuilt it so many times that when the historians went back and studied it, they figured only a couple of original pieces made the entire trip. A strut here, a rudder part there. Everything else, the wings, the engine, the skids, the frame, had been replaced along the way, some of it more than once. It's the old riddle about Grandpa's axe. The one that's had three new heads and four new handles, but it's still Grandpa's axe. That was the VinFizz, an airplane that crossed a continent by being rebuilt underneath its own name the whole way across. On the 5th of November 1911, 49 days after leaving New York, Cal Rogers landed in Pasadena, California. A crowd of 20,000 people met him. They wrapped him in an American flag. He had done it. He was the first human being to fly across the United States of America. But he wasn't quite finished, and this is the detail that tells you everything about the man's stubbornness. Pasadena wasn't the ocean, and Cal Rogers had said ocean to ocean. So a few days later, he took off again to fly the last little stretch to the beach at Long Beach, to put his wheels, or his skids, right down at the edge of the Pacific. And wouldn't you know it, he crashed one more time on that final hop, broke his ankle, hurt his spine, ended up in the hospital. He'd flown across a whole continent and nearly killed himself in the last few miles. He would not let it go. In December, still hobbling, still healing, he had them prop him up and he flew the VinFizz the last stretch down to the water and rolled it right out into the wet sand where the Pacific comes up the beach, ocean to ocean. 84 days from the first takeoff to that last one. If you count the whole thing start to finish, about 4,000 miles flown, and of that 84 days, only a small handful were actually spent in the air. The rest was crashing and mending and waiting on parts and starting over. Now I have to tell you the hard part because I'm not going to hand you a fairy tale. Cal Rogers didn't get to grow old telling this story at a fly-in breakfast the way I'm telling it to you. The next spring, in April of 1912, he was flying near that same Long Beach, showing off over the water where he'd finished his great flight, and something went wrong. Some say he flew into a flock of gulls and one jammed his controls. The airplane went into the surf. Cal Rogers was killed. He was 33 years old. He'd been a pilot for less than a year, less than a year. And in that 1 year, he did a thing that the whole rest of the world was still saying couldn't be done. So why does this matter? Why am I sitting here in the hangar telling you about a grape soda biplane and a half-deaf man with a cigar? Because Cal Rogers is the beginning of something you and I take completely for granted. Every one of us who's ever pushed a throttle up and pointed the nose toward a horizon and thought, I wonder if I can make it that far. We're all flying in Cal Rogers' wake. He was the first man to look at this enormous country, coast to coast, mountains and deserts and prairie and river, and say, I'm going to fly over the top of all of it, and then actually do it. In an airplane, you and I would be terrified to taxi, let alone fly back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free. We used to say the difference between a pilot and a passenger is that a pilot decides where the airplane is going. Cal Rogers decided. The prize couldn't hold him to it, and losing the prize couldn't stop him. That's not about the airplane. The airplane was junk, beautiful, historic junk. That was about the man. And here's the piece I love the most. The VinFizz survived. That patched up, rebuilt, Grandpa Zach's of an airplane, or enough of it to count, ended up preserved. You can go see it. It hangs today in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington. A little cotton and spruce pusher biplane, with a soda pop name painted on it, hanging there among the rockets and the jets, quietly reminding everybody who walks under it that the first man to cross this country did it $4 and $5 at a time, one crash at a time, one cigar at a time. My thanks today to the historians and archivists at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, whose records on the VinFizz and on Cal Rogers keep this story honest, and to the old accounts from the newspapers of 1911 that followed that train across America day by day. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. Next time you're grinding across the country at altitude, warm with a moving map lit up in front of you and the whole world figured out, spare one thought for the tall man out in the slipstream, soaked in castor oil following the railroad tracks west, because he said he would. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the greasy side down.